Well, comrades and fellow workers, during the course of Comrade Baldwin's remarks, he made reference to this wonderful movie that he would like to see, or it actually exists, but given a fantastic viewpoint, it's a Ferlinghetti Baldwin production about capitalism. And he painted a picture and showed you really what like the society is that we live in. Well, all of us, because of our poverty, are forced into the position of going along and watching. Sometimes we pay a dollar or 10 bob at a gate in order to see a fantasy enacted in a screen. Most of us pay 10 shillings or a pound a week in order to see imitations of the world on a television screen. And I'm no different in that respect. That I went along to see a film called War and Peace. The reason I went along was one of the times I was malingering out of the gaffer's reach, and I decided to do a thing that I thought would be very clever. It would make me a part of the literati, the cognoscenti of Glasgow boozers, as I would read War and Peace, something that I thought I should do. So one week I lay in my bed and I read it and enjoyed it. And I recommend any of you fellow escapists to take a week off your work, nothing to do with socialism, and read War and Peace. You'll enjoy it. So I was so enthralled by it, I saw that the local movie house was putting on War and Peace in two parts. And I went along. It was an officially sponsored thing by the Russian government. It was brilliantly done. As far as I could see, the whole Russian army and about half the population of Russia were in it. And I got a whole bit, the Battle of Borodino and so on, the retreat from Moscow, and it was excellent entertainment. Later on, I learned on the television, an old film, that the Americans had done it first. In other words, they had produced this movie, which to me, and it's a personal thing, wasn't quite as enjoyable. But I was interested in the fact that the Americans had done it first. Because understand, from the usual unreliable sources, that the Russian government are making another movie. You've probably seen it, but I live in the sticks. And it's called Karl Marx. And I wonder, along with my fellow movie fan here on the left, if the Americans will beat them to the punch again, and we'll have Robert Redford with a big beard doing it. Because what I'm interested in is in that much quoted, much thought about, much misunderstood passage, an introduction to the Critique of Political Economy, for Marx talks about his view of the world. A basic, simple statement, it's hardly a page, page and a half, of his viewpoint, and his co-worker, Frederick Engels, his viewpoint on how society changes. It's called the materialist conception of history. And nowadays, of course, it's a sort of MA or BA, you can do it. It's an easy thing, go 3 or 4 years at university, and what do? You write the materialist conception of history, or the Marxian view of Scott Fitzgerald's Great Gatsby, or you get your do a thesis on the Marxist view of Donald Duck, or Pluto, or something very interesting and important. That page and a half is full of ideas. Now, I've not worked them out, and in my viewpoint, the writers and the speakers of the Socialist Party of Great Britain have not worked out the fullness of that viewpoint. But if you look at the Socialist Standard from 1904 to 1976, you will see the day-to-day working of men faced with problems using that central viewpoint, the materialist conception of history. And what does it mean? Well, it means a lot of different things. And it'd be foolish of Dick Donnelly, a member of the Socialist Party of Great Britain, to paraphrase it. But just to illustrate one point about it, it means, amongst other things, that men get their ideas from the real material world they live in. And that in turn, men change the real material world that they live in because of their ideas. That's an oversimplification. Okay, I agree with that. But thinking on speakers of the Socialist Party of Great Britain in Glasgow, and I've no doubt it applies to the world socialist movement throughout the world, their environment, their real social conditions, even shape how they think and how they speak. One simple example. When I first came in contact with the Socialist Party of Great Britain, they used to speak at a place called West Regent Street, which is just a street downtown Glasgow. And behind them, with a loudspeaker, was the Communist Party. So when you started speaking for the Socialist Party, and you heard this thing drumming in the back of you all the time, you tended to become an expert in Russia. It just got through to you. I mean, you weren't a member of the Socialist Party of Great Britain unless you had a copy of Soviet Millionaires in your pocket, and unless you could quote the 1931 yearbook, the Soviet Union. That was part and parcel. That shaped you into becoming a member of the Socialist Party of Great Britain. But nowadays, in Glasgow, no outdoor meetings of the Communist Party. So when the Socialist Party of Great Britain speaks on a Saturday afternoon, there's other influences to hear. And on a Sunday afternoon in the Barrowland, an outdoor market, there's other influences that shape what is the ordinary, run-of-the-mill Socialist Party of Great Britain speaker. And it's the Hallelujahs. It's the Pie in the Sky Merchants. It's Jehovah's Jazz Band. And behind you, you can hear this amplified voice. And it always, more or less always, in between hymns, usually you get a bloke come along and say, well, I used to be a drunk. Used to be a drug addict, used to do this, and they used to do it, and it becomes quite interesting. You know? Especially when the women speak. And then, of course, comes the big night when either an overdose of aspirin or bottles of Lanlick, they saw the light, they heard the big voice, and they changed their whole lifestyle. That's how they speak. And it's got to the stage, that's how we're beginning to speak, and that's certainly how I intend to speak. I intend to give one of those testaments. You know, I used to be a sinner, and I saw the SPGB, and it's all been changed. That's what I intend to do. Don't laugh, it's true. The first time I ever heard the Socialist Party of Great Britain, and that almost sounded like the beginning of a pop song, the first time I ever saw your face. And it's a bit like that. As a lodger of my mother's. Now, we lived in a 2-apartment, and with a lodger. Get poorer than that if you can. And this guy, who's a right fly, clever, cunning member of the Socialist Party of Great Britain, said to me, Joe Mugg, 16, I see you read a lot. You know, he's looking through my back numbers of the Beano and answering. A heavyweight intellectual. So, of course, what could you say about, you know. So he then went on to tell me, what do you think of this idea? A world, he said, where no one owned anything. So I looked at him. And so I never knew this bloke took a bevy. I thought he was as straight as a die. A world, he said, where everybody worked to the best of their ability and took according to their needs. What do you think of that? Well, I said, given it my usual 30-second perusal. Great idea. That's a great idea. But, and there's always a but, isn't there? It won't work. It won't work. I wasn't talking about my neighbours round about me, most of whom wouldn't work anyway. I said, this whole concept of a world where people work to the best of their ability and take according to their needs, I was in favour of it. I'd never heard it articulated, but I was in favour of it. I didn't say, oh, that's a terrible idea. I prefer people being poor and people being rich. I like mental hospitals. I like prisons. I like wars. I like all these things. Right away, I thought, beautiful idea, but it won't work. And for the next 18 months, that man done nothing else with me except explain how it would work in any detail. What about this? What about that? What about this? What about that? And through it all, I gradually changed my ideas. Now, Comrade Baldwin's talking about a change in a social system. Now, that change in that social system appears like a tremendous revolution. It is. Not only appears, it is a tremendous revolution. It's a revolution that will make the change from feudalism to capitalism seem like, well, we could have expected that to happen. This is a transformation so amazing, so far-reaching, that most people say, well, it just couldn't happen. Now, it is as near or is it as far as that hour, that 18 months that man spoke to me? Because since I joined the Socialist Party of Great Britain, I've not yet heard one idea about how socialism won't work that I didn't express. Not heard it yet. At an outdoor meeting or an indoor meeting or in a boozer or wherever. Wherever we're talking about socialism, I've not yet heard any idea. That's not unique. Because if I return to what Karl Marx was dealing with in that introduction to the Critique of Political Economy, he was talking about how men get their ideas from the real world to live in. And of course, all my oppositions to this new society, this new concept, weren't because I was a particularly brilliant person. I got these oppositions to socialism from my father, from my mother, from the kids I played with, from my school teacher. I'm sorry, comrades, from my Sunday school teacher as well. I got it from all my surroundings. That's where I got these ideas. It's true. I wasn't just a puppet, an automatic robot. No doubt I expressed them differently. And I may even have come up with a strange, bizarre opposition to socialism. But basically, I came up with these ideas that I hear people now expressing as oppositions to socialism. And most of them, most oppositions to socialism, have as a basic premise this: a misunderstanding of what socialism is. Socialism, the concept of everybody in the world owning everything on and in the planet, with every human being working to the best of their ability and taking according to their needs, is no new idea. Ever since gens society, tribal society, broke up, in some cases to become chattel slavery in some areas, to develop into patriarchal society, later on into feudalism, and later on, of course, into worldwide capitalism. Ever since the breakup of that tribal society, there's been a dream around. There's been a concept of a golden age that men somehow or other suspect they may have had and they've lost. The religious people put it in the concept of a Garden of Eden. People who have looked at modern primitives, who are nearer that primitive society than we are in modern capitalism, say it's in the myths, in the stories, in the folklore. Historians look at it and say in the 14th century in Germany, with uprisings of people talking about a golden past and a golden future. Friedrich Engels in the peasant war in Germany describes that viewpoint. In this country, during the Cromwellian Revolution, we also get groups who start expressing this old idea, the golden age that's past and is to come. In other words, it's not a new form, intellectual idea. Men and women have always had this concept that somewhere along the line, They're living in a society that's not satisfying their needs. Some have put a religious halo around it, like the Wat Tylers and the John Balls and so on. Some, on the other hand, have just spoken about it, that it's only clever people who can understand it. Some of the levellers and the diggers were later on to become the nonconformist ministers and what have you. But that dream has always been there. It's in the folklore and the legend of people throughout the world. In China, for instance, they've got this folklore about this new society, this golden age that's going to return to a golden age that they never had. Now, the Socialist Party of Great Britain don't deal in myths and folklores and dreams and utopias. We deal with practical propositions. But of course, to someone whose concept of human beings, of men and women, is that a successful man or woman is someone who consumes wealth, and a really successful man or woman is a person who consumes more and more and more wealth. That's how you look upon a successful man today, that he's in a position to satisfy appetites that he's not even dreamt up. In other words, the possessor of great wealth is a great man or a great woman. Now, the Socialist Party takes the viewpoint that what they're after is socialism. That concept, not a mythical golden age of the past and a mythical golden age of the future, but that they see out the real problems using this materialist conception of history, saying, as my comrade Baldwin has pointed out, that all the social problems that arise out of the fact that we have reached a certain stage in social evolution. And to reach the next stage in it demands a conscious, class-conscious effort by the majority of the men and women who happen to be, in this society, members of the working class. And socialism here, although it could be depicted as a cure-all, a Dr. Quack's medicine cure-all, this bottle, this socialism, it's going to get rid of poverty, it's going to get rid of war, it's going to get rid of unemployment, it's going to get rid of you going down on your knees to the gaffer and cringing on Monday. This is a miracle cure, socialism. And we're aware of the fact that that can be easily parodied. But what are the facts? War? Unemployment? Bad housing, racialism, crime, all the problems my comrade has mentioned are the outcome, the inevitable, inescapable outcome of a competitive society. Private property was a step forward in the development of producing wealth. It has now reached the stage where it is a fetter, a restriction on producing wealth. Other than social considerations, there is no reason why any human being on earth this evening should go to bed hungry. Other than social reasons, there is no reason why men at the prime of their life should destroy wealth and destroy each other, should be trained in the best way of killing each other. Other than social reasons, there is no reason why people live in inadequate housing and live substandard lives. Other than social reasons, there is just no reason for all the problems. We live in a society where wealth is produced with only one object, to sell it in the marketplace in order to realise a society. We, wild-eyed utopians that we are after a society where wealth is produced for a really crazy, insane idea, to satisfy social need. In other words, our view of socialism is that we will produce food to feed the hungry. We'll produce clothes and housing and all the rest of it to satisfy social need. Now, that may be looked upon by the cynics and the sneerers as a crazy utopia. We don't see it that way. And I'll close here, Comrade Chairman. I see you're getting anxious. We see it as a practical alternative that all that is called for, and I'm saying all as if it meant nothing, it's a great deal. What is called for is a majority of the working class doing what comes naturally. The reason that men came out the trees is because they were discontented. The reason that men moved from being food gatherers to hunters, from hunters to farmers, was because they were discontented. In other words, they were living in a world, an environment, which wasn't satisfying their needs, and they dealt with the problem. All we ask you to do, fellow members of the working class, is express your discontent, and you are discontented, not by going in futile demonstrations or looking for a leader or a support, but doing the most important thing that a member of the working class can do today. Look seriously at how you live and how you might live. Ask yourself the question, why these social problems? Why war? Why poverty? Why not the wild-eyed dreamers, the utopians' viewpoint of a world based on common ownership, where men and women will be able to live in a society where our children won't live under the constant cloud of another world war, of another international holocaust, where men and women will be able to say each day, we worked to the best of our ability, we took according to our needs. Tonight we're tired, tomorrow we wake up to another day of freedom. Thank you.
Yes, certainly.
I'd like to refer to the horror film that was spoken about by the first speaker. What he omitted, the most important thing that he omitted, was that the capitalists, when in power, they have to need an army to defend their dictatorship. And that at this stage, in fact, capitalism has risen to a level of imperialism, and that at this stage, it is, you know, we have come to a stage where imperialism has reached when it is about to collapse, and that the international, that imperialism is in fact, it's not a question. That my question will come after. Yes. Yes, imperialism is defended. Imperialism is in fact the international dictatorship of the bourgeoisie, and that it has got its own army, military organizations to defend this, such as NATO, Warsaw Pact, and so on. So the proletariat, which is an international class, has to have an army to defeat the bourgeoisie. And in the world today, the proletariat has established its dictatorship in at least one quarter of mankind, that is in China. And that the army of the People's Liberation Army of China is in fact the proletarian internationalist army. And that with this army, the people of the world, which is today, it formed in the International United Front around the Communist Party of China. With these three magic weapons, we are able at this stage today, the stage is ripe for the people of the world, led by the Communist Party of China, with the People's Liberation Army of China, to defeat the two superpowers. Yes. 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 The question is tied up. This is
to answer. Yes. Now, if you want to come back later, raise your hand and we'll invite you up.
My question is
Madam,
tied up.
Please, I'm asking you.
I haven't asked my question yet.
If you will ask your question briefly,
yes.
Then.
My question
briefly.
Is this: the quintessence of Marxism is dictatorship of the proletariat. How come then that you oppose dictatorship of the proletariat, you don't uphold Lenin, you don't uphold Chairman Mao, which is Lenin of this era?
Well, that is so much for the democratic dictatorship, if you want to give it its full title, it's contradiction in terms, of the People's Republic of China. We are back to the early days of the Communist Party in this country, inspired by Russia, hurling this word imperialism at its competitors in the West, where in fact this word imperialism becomes a political swear word, a word of abuse, which one gang of capitalist imperialists hurl at the other by way of poking the finger of motivation to draw attention away from their own ambitions. What is the Chinese army of occupation doing in Tibet? Isn't that imperialism? What is the Chinese army doing strung out along the frontier of Russia? And of course, conversely, the Russian army strung out along its frontier with China. If it's not a traditional, sordid and typical old capitalist dispute over questions of territories and frontiers and annexations. All of these are the classic features of conflict within capitalist society and have nothing whatever to do with the working class. The working class have a world interest in common in ending frontiers. In socialism, there will be no frontiers. Socialist territories, when the Earth is socialist, you won't have lines drawn by men on maps saying China ends here and Russia starts there, and we'll blow you to pieces if you step over this man-drawn line on a map. Socialism will abolish frontiers from the face of the earth. These are the lines of national demarcation within which modern capitalism operates its plunder and exploitation of the working class. And China, of course, is at it up to their necks. Modern Chinese capitalism you can see mirrored today in modern state capitalist Russia with their single party police state dictatorship, the future which state capitalism in China has in store for it. And you're wrong again when you say that in my opening, in talking about the horror epic movie by way of trying to illustrate what we mean by capitalism, that I didn't talk about the armies of the capitalist class. In fact, I did say that this whole production is assisted in its distribution throughout the world by nationalist frontiers and the coercive state machine of the capitalist class. But as much as you might be in love with the parrot phrases and the jingo slogans of Leninism, particularly in regard to imperialism, you have yet to understand the Marxist concept of what a classless society means, and to understand what Marx meant by the state machine. If you look in China and Russia, you will see a powerful state apparatus, and when you understand that from the Marxist or socialist point of view, the very existence of the state machine demonstrates that society is divided into classes, because the state machine, the apparatus of the coercive central powers of government, only develops with alongside with the division of society into classes and the property antagonism and hostile class interests that this gives rise to, in this case, between the capitalist and working class within the frontiers of the national state boundaries, and of course between rival gangs of capitalists like the Chinese and the Russians on the one hand, or the Americans and the EEC on the other, or the Americans and the Chinese. You can cross-reference it any way you like, but the state machine exists as the strong-arm boy, the coercive central apparatus of the capitalist class. That is why the Chinese ruling class have a state machine, and that is why the state machine developed historically. Now, so far as the armies, the question of armies, the armies exist as part of the coercive machinery of the capitalist class to defend their property and to extend their property ambitions, to gain, if they can, the lion's share of the plunder about the face of the earth. So far as armies are concerned, they serve no purpose and have no bearing on the interests of the working class at all. Socialism will be a world without armies, and the whole emphasis and inference that you draw, that the working class will have to raise its own army to fight the army of the capitalist, is one of civil war and universal murder and bloodshed, The Socialist Party of Great Britain rejects this. This is very much part of the horror movie we want to get away from. When a majority of workers withdraw their support from capitalism and cease to adhere to the belief and the fallacy that capitalism is the only possible society, they will stop voting for political parties like the Maoists and the Bolsheviks or the present-day Communist Party, the Labour Party, the Tories and the rest of them, and they will use their votes to gain control of the central governmental apparatus as the only means of taking out of the hands of the capitalist class their monopoly of the ownership of the means of production and distribution. This will not pave the way to dictatorship in the form that you understand it. The phrase dictatorship of the proletariat has been bandied about by all of these leftist elitists who seek only to climb up on the backs of the working class, and the dictatorship that they are interested in is a dictatorship to the working class, not a dictatorship of the working class, which would mean that the working class are a politically mature and a revolutionary class in the sense that they have achieved social dominance for the purpose of ending class society. You must resolve this final point in your mind about the dictatorship of the proletariat. Either the proletariat is going to continue to exist, and therefore you have class society, coercive state apparatus, and hostile national frontiers, therefore all the ramifications of capitalism. Either you're going to have a proletariat at all, which presupposes the continuation of class society, or you're going to have the revolutionary change to socialism and class society, where the final act of the proletariat, whereby it consciously achieves state power, will be the act where, at one fell swoop, it will end class society and at one and the same time end its existence as a proletariat by establishing classless society and world common ownership.
Well, friends, our speakers have raised a number of points here tonight. I can't believe that every member of the audience agrees with all the things that they've said. There must be a question on the point Comrade Donnelly raised, perhaps, of is it a possibility that we can enter into a phase of common ownership? Objections to it? I see one. Well, I don't know. If it's, yes, sir.
How do you propose to get rid of armies, then?
Who wants to go there?
How do you abolish armies? How do you get rid of armies?
Well, we take a viewpoint.
I'll repeat the question for the tape recorder, not for MV here. Yeah. I don't know why they want to tape this. But
how do we propose to get rid of armies?
Yeah. How do we propose to get rid of armies? Fair enough. Well, our viewpoint is before you start dealing with that, you've got to say to yourself, why have we got armies? Where did they come about from? When people lived in a primitive society, they hadn't an army. I mean, the army is a product of the first class division in society, the advent of chattel slavery. The first police force that ever existed in the world was in the chattel slave society, an Athenian society, a chattel slave society. They had a police force. Now, why did they need it? Incidentally, the first policemen were slaves. Why did they get it? How did it come about? Well, it came about because for the first time, instead of men being related to each other through kinship, because I was related to him, or I was my uncle, my cousin, and so on, and we had a common bond, men no longer had that. Gens society broke up, and the important thing was ownership, with the birth of private property. And the minute you've got private property, it presupposes something, an owner and a non-owner. And also, of course, the non-owners have never fancied being non-owners. And the owners have tried to protect their ownership. That's the whole reason for a state apparatus. That's the whole reason for police forces and armies. Now, inside a socialist society, where there is no private property, there is no need to protect it. Now you say, how do you get rid of the army? Well, the army in Britain, as an example, in the defence expenditure debates, every year the British Parliament, and likewise in other countries where capitalism exists all over the world, to debate how much money, how much food, clothing, shelter and equipment, how much social effort will go into this army. And there's all sorts of debates about it. You've got left-wingers saying less, right-wingers saying more, and middle of the road men say, well, maybe a bit more here and a bit less here. And that's what the newspapers are full of in a defence expenditure debate. But Parliament decides the size of the army and basically whether they'll have an army. Now, it's essential you have an army if you've got private property. It's pointless having an army if you've no private property. How do we get rid of it? Well, we take the viewpoint that once the majority of the world's population have shown democratically that they're in favour of this transformation from private property to common property, from production for profit to production for use, once you've got that situation, armies are impossible. Like my comrade said, customs posts, passports, boundaries are unthinkable. The world now belongs to the whole human race. This can only come about when a majority of the working class become politically mature. Now, what need would we have for an army, or a policeman, or a jailer, or a lawyer, or a ticket collector inside a society, socialism, where there's no private property? What will happen inside socialism, and I've no crystal ball to tell you, you know, what will happen each day, or as one comrade in Glasgow rather unfortunately termed them, we haven't got crystal balls. That what will happen is the army and the whole state apparatus will, in a classical Marxian phrase, wither away. It may be, I don't know, it may be that at the first part of it, when a majority have expressed their viewpoint for socialism and have control for the first time of the means of production and distribution, they may use the army. It's a big organisation, it's got a lot of equipment. They may use it at the start to transport food, clothing and shelter throughout the globe. They may use it in all sorts of fashions. But eventually, it will wither away because the basis of an army, private property, will have been abolished. The army, along with all the other paraphernalia of capitalist society, will disappear. Not because men have had a change of heart, but because the social system won't need them. What happened to the men who produced armour for the medieval knights? They didn't have a change of heart. They became redundant with the use of artillery and the use of guns and gunpowder and all the rest of it. They became redundant, useless, part of history. Armies will become useless, like passports will become useless, when the cause of these things, private property, has disappeared.
The people must wait until the whole world is politically conscious, instead of those that are politically conscious now organizing to seize state power and laying conditions to politicize the working people of the world.
How?
I'm sorry. Would you correct me if I've got your question incorrectly? Did you ask, must we wait until the majority of the world's workers understand socialism, and therefore socialist understanding is with the majority of people, yeah, or can we...
We stay on this oppressive condition that we live in on now, until the world or the world's people become politicized or socially politicized, yeah, instead of those that are socially politicized now, socially conscious.
Yeah, I see.
That's using state power.
Or can we take action now as a minority?
minority.
Yeah.
The working
class
is a minority.
No, the socialists in the working class are the minority.
Can we take, can we do something?
Thank you. Well, our answer to this question is that you only have to reflect for a moment on the kind of far-reaching and fundamental worldwide changes that have been talked about by the Socialist Party of Great Britain since its inception in 1904, but for the purposes of your question, by tonight's meeting from this platform. The ending of class society, the ending of the world of frontiers, the finish of the state machine, the ending of armed forces and coercive governmental machinery, the abolition of the wages system, the end of production for sale and profit, no more market economy, the institution of a world of common ownership where all the goods and amenities and services of life are produced abundantly for free distribution about the earth for the sole purpose of satisfying people's needs. You only have to think about this proposition for a moment to realise that its attainment is impossible unless and until an overwhelming majority of people throughout the world understand it and want it. To reason your question backwards, if only a minority wanted it, this would mean that the vast majority of people still accepted and went along with, however full of moans and groans, they acquiesced in and accepted, realised no alternative to the continuation of the wages system. They look upon money, and as my comrade Donnelly said earlier on, the accumulation of wealth and trying to get more and more in what they call their acquisitive society, so that your success or failure is judged by how much you own of the wealth of society, they would still accept these standards of capitalist society. They would still accept the standards of buying and selling. They would still accept the standards of export trades and balances of payments, of gold reserves and inflation, and all the government apologia and the pain-in-the-neck excuses they endlessly trot out for their failures to remove social promises. Their thinking would not have got beyond this level. Now, you couldn't conceive of abolishing this society, pulling the rug out from under their feet, while they're completely unaware of what is happening. Because what happens in the immediate future, when you've established the world of common ownership, is that the same people, the vast majority of the world's population, are going to be the citizens of future socialist society. They are going to be the ones who run it. We don't set out to lead anybody. We don't put ourselves up as some elite or vanguard who's going to show a blind and ignorant mass the way home. We've always said our principal stake, Clause 5, that the establishment of socialism, the emancipation of the working class, must be the work of the working class itself. So the whole onus and responsibility rests with you. And it's inconceivable that the wages system, the whole monetary apparatus of class society and production for sale and profit, could be swept from the earth whilst the vast majority of people were unready for it and were still going along with the general acceptance of capitalism and the way it operates throughout the world. So, yes, it's not neither is it a question that we, to come back to the way you framed it, that we must wait until a majority want it and understand it. On the contrary, we must propagate the alternative, we must expound socialism, and we must work in order to bring about this change of ideas. We must explain our ideas, we must interpret the world in which we live in such a way that our fellow workers can understand from the light of their own experience that the case for socialism is the only valid one. But regardless of how stifled and frustrated you may feel, and we share this with you, that being a minority in a world which as yet hasn't latched onto the ideas of socialism is a very difficult and stifling situation to live in and to try and come to terms with. But no matter how much you may feel restrained and hemmed in, until that majority want it, it cannot be achieved. And therefore, the only useful thing you can do with your time, if you really want socialism, is not to follow the will of the wisp, thinking, deluding yourself, that you can jump the gun by some desperate minority action which will short circuit the whole process and sort of sneak up on them and throw it at them when they're when they're not looking and they're unprepared for it. You'll only, at the end of the day, reap a harvest of despair and disillusionment, as have all those who have tried this kind of procedure. Because socialism rests upon the overwhelming majority, they are going to be the ones who run it. It will be a democratic society where everybody will stand in the same equal relationship to the earth and all that's in it and on it. And you cannot usher in such a fundamentally different way of life until and unless the overwhelming majority of people are not only ready for it, and the process doesn't stop with organising and voting for it, but recognising that with all of the privileges that a classless and a free society will mean, will go the responsibility for working and producing wealth in a free and equal fashion, in order that society can enjoy in a free and equal way the common products of their social labour.
Before we take the next question, I'd like to thank you for a collection of £35, 25 pence. Is there another question? Gentlemen, you...
Comrade Baldwin has answered the first part of the last question of the double-barrel question, but nevertheless, the question of the back thinks that that's far too long to wait for a majority of class-conscious socialists. What he wants is for the